Hi. So today on the Loopcast, I have Colin Cookman, and we are talking about Pakistan. So Colin has a new report out detailing sort of Pakistani elections and what to expect in the elections coming up in May. So let's start off with Pakistan is this I find that in national security circles it's really controversial, but there's not a lot of it's always we always discuss Pakistan as a matter of, external politics, relationship with the US, relationship with Afghanistan, India, Iran. But, a lot of focus hasn't been on Pakistan's internal dynamics. So sort of give us a background of, this transition from military rule from sort of the Musharraf period to sort of Zardari and sort of, what has changed, what stayed the same? I mean, judging by your report, we've, gone from this very centralized, controlled, country, and the trend seems to be towards decentralization. I mean, at least that's what I got from reading the report.
I mean, first of all, thanks for having me. I mean, this report I wrote for the Center for American Progress. It's up on their website. It's called Previewing Pakistan's 2013 Elections, if anyone's interested. I mean, not to, I don't want to sort of overstate it, but I think generally that the there has been a pretty sort of noticeable shift inside Pakistan and a lot of the politics of the country that I do think, I mean, part of the reason why I wrote this report is because I do think for the most part, American policymakers, and that's mainly the audience here, are viewing Pakistan in the context of, as you said, Afghanistan, terrorism issues, drones, those tend to be the big sort of focuses. And I actually think, it's been 5 years now since, well, 5 years basically since the end of the Musharraf government, the introduction of democratically elected government again. And at least from, I mean, I've mostly been observing this from abroad, but from what I can tell, it does seem to, there do seem to have been some pretty significant shifts in the way the political system works now, as compared to sort of the, I mean, certainly compared to the early 2000s, initially after Musharraf came into power. You've had, I mean, you've had elections, you've had this parliamentary government, which sort of against all odds has held on for the full 5 year tenure, which is something no other civilian government in Pakistan has ever managed to do. And it's basically done that. The PPP, Zardari, the first Prime Minister Gilani, and now it's Prime Minister Ashraf, have basically held on by, frantic negotiations basically with everyone else in the country whenever it looks like they're sort of nearing a crisis, because they do face challenges from all these different sides, from the courts, from the military, from other political rivals. And so I really think that, I mean, the effect has been, I mean, it's sort of the coalition government effect that you see in places. I mean, we see it in India, you see it in other countries around the world, but regional parties, smaller parties have really been able to sort of leverage their ability to sort of provide that marginal support to the government. So, I mean, again, not to sort of oversell this, not that this has sort of never happened in Pakistan's history before. There has been sort of a cycle of sort of centralizing military authorities that then eventually either they die in office like Zia, or they are ousted, give up power eventually, and are replaced by civilian governments, which sort of try, for the most part, the civilian politicians have had their bases more in the provinces, trying to push down more authority to the provinces. So it's not sort of totally unprecedented for Pakistan's history, but for this duration, it's, I mean, for the full 5 year term, and now it looks like these elections are going to happen. It's going to at least continue for the immediately foreseeable future. I think it is quite important for Pakistan and for countries like the US as we try and deal with Pakistan. I think we have to sort of grapple with, I mean, there's not just sort of I mean, there's not just sort of one guy that we can go to when we engage with Pakistan. It's a very, I mean, even for the elected government, it's Zardari or whoever else, they don't have necessarily the power to sort of implement policy in the way that maybe a military executive did at one point.
So before we get into the sort of the gritty of the elections, sort of lay out sort of how is the relation, you touched on this, how is the relationship between the military, the civilian government, and the judiciary? I mean, in your report, you highlighted that sort of the judiciary has become sort of more independent, or at least has sort of freed itself more from political control. So how does, sort of explain this dynamic to the audience, how, you know, how does it work? You know, what's this dynamic between the military, the judiciary, and the civilian government? And will that have an effect on, has that had an effect on sort of politics and sort of, you know, how things are run?
Yeah, I mean, this is super complicated and very much has a lot to do with politics sort of writ large. So if I'm rambling on for too long here, please cut in. But generally speaking, I think the military leadership post Musharraf under General Kayani, who's been on an office for pretty much, what is it, 6 years now, 7 years, I forget exactly, but he had a term extension. Kayani has, generally speaking, been trying to sort of repair a lot of the damage to the military's reputation that it became associated with Musharraf personally and his personal leadership. So the military, certainly in areas where it's sort of institutional privileges, which basically means, you know, setting its own budgets effectively, setting a lot of defense and foreign policy, and the military also has pretty considerable domestic economic assets as well that it controls, protecting its current and former members from sort of judicial scrutiny or prosecution. Still been quite assertive in those regards, but in a lot of other areas, it's at least, the military has at least sort of sought to give the public appearance of sort of ceding more ground to the politicians. Partly maybe that's just because managing Pakistan right now is a really, it's not a job that too many people necessarily would want. So maybe the military is happy to have the civilian government take the blame for a lot of the economic problems and other issues that are happening right now. But at least seem to be ceding more ground in some areas. At the same time, you've had the courts under Chief Justice Chaudhry really move to assert themselves as an independent branch. I think kind of following, very much following the model in India, the courts have used sort of the suo moto power where they can basically, the court can initiate its own legal proceedings on anything that happens to catch the Chief Justice's eye. But also the lawyers movement, which sort of affiliated with the courts, and some other political parties, which have sort of used the courts as a means to challenge the PPP government at times, they have moved to basically the current system for judicial appointments since the passage of the 18th Amendment to the Pakistani Constitution. A few years back, the courts basically now select their own membership for promotions, for appointments. And pretty much that's been a power that the Zardari government has given up, in some cases they've tried to sort of favor their own candidates or ignore the court's orders. And the court has basically pushed back on that. And so far, the government has more or less accepted that pushback. So you have a more assertive and definitely very much active in sort of policy issues, like responding to violence in places like Karachi or Balochistan. You have the court very much engaged and very much seeking to sort of enforce its orders on both I mean, primarily on the civilian politicians, but also on the military as well. They've mostly only, the courts have mostly only gone after the retired military officials so far. But with Pervez Musharraf returning to the country, there's it seems likely that now, at least as long as he remains in the country, Chief Justice Chaudhry is likely to take kind of a sharp eye to more recent history of military activities, at least under Musharraf's government. So basically, you have this, you have multiple actors. It's not, we're going to have an election. There will be hundreds of candidates. There will be multiple parties involved in forming the next government. But this is only a part of the broader political system in which you have unelected officials, either in the military bureaucracy, in to some extent in the civilian bureaucracies, and then in the courts as well, all which also are sort of jostling for power and sort of the overall trend in Pakistani politics over the past couple of years has been this, and this is something that we can also see happening in Egypt right now and other places. This sort of contest to basically set the rules of authority, who actually gets to decide on issues, who makes the final call on some of these issues. So that I think is likely to continue, although there are going to be leadership transitions on the military and the judicial side as well this year after the elections take place. And potentially in the presidency, Zardari, as well. So it will be a big year of change generally, I think, however it turns out, for Pakistan.
Oh, okay. So let's sort of not switch gears, but sort of, put on our election night hats on, and let's start, discussing the election. So we have, walk us through, like in your report, you have a you list out all the parties that are participating in the elections, and coming from a background of American politics, this was really shocking because there's six or seven major parties, and sort of lead us through and sort of highlight like who are these major parties, who's leading these major parties, sort of
Sure.
we oh thanks.
Sure. So Pakistan, even during periods of military rule, Pakistan has no sort of shortage of political actors. And certainly in the past 5 years, you've had a big rebound by the parties, generally in terms of their activities. The current government, it's led by the Pakistan People's Party, PPP. It's which I mean I should say we're I think we'll probably mostly end up talking about the national elections, but there are also going to be provincial elections happening simultaneously for the four provincial assembly governments. So the PPP leads the national government, leads the government provincial government in Sindh, and is supporting coalition members in Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces. The PPP, they're gonna, I think, have a tough. I don't want to attempt to forecast too much, but because I think it's gonna be a very complicated picture, whatever the outcome may be. But the PPP, they've been in charge for 5 years. They've had some significant accomplishments in terms of. In terms of reaching some political consensus on issues like provincial autonomy and these sorts of things, these sorts of power sharing questions. But in terms of economic management and just the general state of security in the country, it's a tough time to be an incumbent. So they're the major, they're the incumbent party. The other major national level party is the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, the PMLN. Which has led the government in Punjab, led by Nawaz Sharif, former prime minister. His brother Shahbaz Sharif is the chief minister of Punjab. And the PMLN, these are the two parties that have traditionally managed to sort of form national level governments. outside of or achieve kind of significant electoral successes outside of their home base. I mean, it's a bit of a generalization, but the PPP has founded in Sindh, the PMLN based in Punjab. The PMLN in particular in the past year or so has made a real big effort to sort of forge alliances or recruit members from smaller sort of regional parties. And I think generally speaking, right now, most analysts are expecting that the PMLN will probably form the next, will probably lead the next coalition government on the basis of its own performance and then being able to sort of cobble together enough supporters around the country. But that said, there are a lot of other regional parties or smaller parties, which, given the fact that this is like you said, I mean, there are, I don't know, six or seven major parties, and then there are even more minor parties or independent candidates, which can really potentially tilt the balance on the margins in parliament. So you have, I mean, you have the MQM party in Karachi, which basically sort of runs, dominates most of Karachi, although there are a few local rivals there. You have the Awami National Party, the ANP, in the Northwest, which is attempting to campaign even as they are coming under serious attack by the Pakistani Taliban. You have, I mean, the big sort of media splash has been the PTI, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, led by Imran Khan. Everybody knows it's the former cricket star, although it's been many years now since he played. But Imran Khan, again, he has led some pretty big rallies around the country. Seems like could have the potential to impact results around the country, but I think not many people are expecting him to win. I mean, I would not expect him to win majorities outright anywhere. So it's going to be a question of how, to what degree does he cut into the other parties' bases, and then who can he form a coalition with? Because he's basically ruled out forming a coalition with anybody who's currently in government, which doesn't leave him a whole lot of options.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, there are other parties. There's the PMLQ, which is the former party established by Pervez Musharraf, which led the government parliament under his tenure from 2002 to 2007. It's deteriorated considerably since losing fairly big in the 2008 elections. But basically, everybody's trying to sort of co-opt the surviving members of that party. The PPP has been in alliance with them for about the past year or so, but it's not clear if they're going to be able to sort of seal a deal on carrying that through the elections themselves. And then there's some, I mean, there are the Islamist parties, which at least in 2008 did not do well, boycotted or performed very poorly. Again, I think these are going to be parties which potentially on the margins might impact at the provincial level or even potentially at the National Assembly level, depending on exactly how divided the outcome is. These smaller parties anywhere have the potential to try and sort of play a kingmaker role, extract more concessions from the national level parties, the PPP or the PMLN, in order to sort of get their support for a coalition. But in terms of actual seats won, probably not that significant.
So, you know, how do we assign political geography then? You know, what are the major, you know, the provinces and the cities which these parties pull from? You know, when, you know, what would PPP consider its base? What would PMLN consider its base? You know, what would MQM, you mentioned that, you know, they pull a lot from Karachi. You know,
right.
How does, you know, how do these parties sort of balance, you know, running at the city level running at the province level and then running at the national level. So,
Right.
sort of outline this sort of dynamic for us.
Right. Well, I mean, first off, I should say there won't be any local elections taking place in this. Local government in Pakistan is pretty complicated. Since 2010, it's basically each province sets up its own system, and for the most part, they've reverted to sort of appointed civil service management at the local level rather than directly elected councils, although that varies province to province. But for the provinces and the national assembly governments, I mean, like I said, generally speaking, the PPP has its strongest base in rural Sindh. Karachi, the city there, the MQM, has its strongest base in Karachi, although that's hotly contested. I mean, part of a lot of violence in Karachi today is relates to sort of political disputes over land access, and there are some potentially very significant court cases going on right now, challenges to voter registration in Karachi, constituency boundaries, all these sorts of local level issues, which it's hard from abroad to sort of get a good sense on exactly what's happening, but these sorts of things can in fact have significant outcomes at the local level, and then that can potentially translate into bigger things at the national level. I mean, generally speaking, Pakistan, although I mean Pakistan's primarily rural, but it has I mean it has been urbanizing quite a bit over the past couple decades. I think I mean the estimates that I've seen are about a third of the population lives in cities right now, but that's not necessarily even it may be more than that. But sort of, I mean, you have this issue in the U.S. as well, the disconnect between sort of the formal constituency boundaries and where people actually live can potentially be quite large. So I think generally speaking, rural Pakistan is probably overrepresented in parliament and in the provincial assemblies compared to the cities. But it's kind of hard to tell because Pakistan hasn't actually conducted a full census since I think 1998. So there's that. I mean, Punjab will be the big battlefield basically for the election at the national level because that's where the largest number of seats and the biggest chunk of the population is. And Punjab is basically where all the major national parties, the PPP, the PMLN, but also the PMLQ and the PTI, have made big efforts. So the breakdown in Punjab will probably go a long way to determining the national outcome. And there, generally speaking, the PPP and the PMLQ are more have a better base in southern Punjab. But that's maybe more detailed than people need to know. I don't know. And then Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan will be it will be I mean those are the provinces with obviously the worst security situation in the country. So I mean maybe with the exception of the federally administered tribal areas, the FATA, but the ANP in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa has led the government, but I think has come under—I mean, it's come under physical attack quite a bit from the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban. And also, generally speaking, I mean, it hasn't been a great 5 years in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa for a lot of people, and partly as a result of just general economic issues, but obviously there's the conflict in Afghanistan happening next door and the spillover from that. So I think my understanding, and again, this is just what I can sort of discern from abroad, so I wouldn't necessarily take this as a super hard and fast prediction, but the ANP is going to have a pretty hard time holding on to its government there. And it's more likely, I think, I've heard other analysts, Arif Rafiq and a few others, suggest that Khyber Pakhtunkhwa actually might be a place where the PTI, Imran Khan's party, could potentially get a significant enough plurality to actually lead a government. maybe probably have to be in coalition with some other religious parties. That said, the PMLN, other religious parties also at play there, so not sure. And then Balochistan, I mean, this was the area with the lowest turnout in the last election. The parliamentary assembly, or the provincial assembly there is, I mean, it's fractured all kinds of ways. It's large portions of it are sort of independent candidates who can potentially switch around any which way. And obviously you have the security situation there. You have, I mean, you still have a fairly large military presence. You have Baloch nationalists, but also, you know, sectarian violence and other sorts of issues. So that would be, I think, the most uncertain outcome in terms of who manages to campaign in that sort of environment and actually pick up seats. I think one notable thing is yesterday, I think, at least as of we're recording this Tuesday, one of the leading Baloch nationalist parties said that, which boycotted in 2008, said that they would actually participate this time. So, so also a very sort of complicated picture there in terms of what the outcome might be given all the mix of factors. But
what are some of the key issues then that, you know, you mentioned that, you know, towards, you know, that, you know, the PTI sort of has taken issue, Imran Khan has taken issue with, you know, drone strikes in Pakistan,
right,
if I have that correctly. But, you know, how is this election, you know, going to affect, you know, is the relationship, you know, with the United States, is that an issue, is that an election issue? Mm. Or, you know, are there subtle shades? You know, PTI has sort of pointed out, you know, Imran Khan has pointed out that, you know, no drone strikes, or I can't remember what his latest Twitter campaign was, but it really seems that, you know, that the United States in one way or the other has played in the election, at least, you know, from the perspective of an outsider. But, you know, is this a really big issue, or is it more, you know, the old Tip O'Neill saying that really all politics and by extension, all elections are local, and it's really about the economy, energy, you know, stuff that you would consider, you know, is more internal and, you know, more in the control of Pakistani politicians as opposed to the Foreign Office, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, so we're not officially in campaign season yet, so I don't know exactly how things will play out. The candidate registration finishes this Friday, and then I think there's about a couple weeks of review, and then it's the basically last half of April, first half of May, that is the official campaign period that we'll see, I think, a lot more speeches and rallies and those sorts of things by candidates. So could change in that period. Certainly, if there's any big sort of flare-up in the relations with the United States, I would not be surprised to see candidates sort of hammer away on that issue, because we're not very popular in Pakistan right now. But but that being said, I think generally speaking, it is going to be sort of local issues and sort of issues of local, the capacity of local candidates to sort of get out the vote and make the sort of promises, retail politics kind of promises that generally speaking, I think characterize most political activity in Pakistan, or at least have so far. I mean, it will be interesting. I mean, Imran Khan has really staked sort of his candidacy on this idea that it's possible to sort of dramatically transform the way politics works in the country and sort of institute these sort of sweeping changes in relations with the U.S., but also domestically as well in terms of corruption and all these other charges. So I'm not sure exactly yet whether he has sort of the support base and a political organization to deliver on that promise, but he is at least sort of out there making that case, and other parties as well, I think, generally speaking, are going to be focusing on sort of deliverables, like, I mean, there's been quite a lot of last minute development, in quotes, project spending by the incumbent government in the past couple months. Whether that's at the national government or the provincial governments as well, the PMLN in Punjab or whoever. But so yeah, generally speaking, I think it will be more local factors. But there are serious policy questions facing whoever comes into office after this. I mean, the economy in particular, if it doesn't happen before the election, they're likely going to need to go to the IMF or some other donor because they are nearing a balance of payments crisis again. The tax revenues are low. Education investment is terribly low. And of course, you have the question of how to engage with the U.S. Or Pakistan's neighbors, how to engage with India. They've sort of had these proposals to open up trade with India, and that seems to kind of stalled out. So I think, I mean, there are some differences amongst the parties on these issues. I think you would have a government led by Imran Khan versus a government led by, Bilal Bhutto. Would be, I think, probably quite different in its approach to the U.S. But that said, they are all operating under the same sort of set of constraints facing Pakistan, and it's just whoever comes into office is going to have a really tough challenge in terms of managing all these issues. And is going to be well. Sorry, just one more point, and it's going to be constrained by the fact that whoever comes into office is almost certainly not going to come into office with a majority or even a significant plurality, and is going to have to find a way to respond to these issues in coalition with a pretty fractious group of political leaders.
Then to sort of build on your point, how much does just foreign policy in general play in the elections? Not just the relationship with the United States, but sort of the relationship with India, the relationship with Iran, and the relationship with Afghanistan. I mean, is this something – how is foreign policy brought into domestic politics, if ever? I mean, you sort of touched on sort of the trade deal with India sort of, you know, faltering and sort of stalling out. But is this, you know, is this really – do you know, is foreign policy – you know, a election issue, you know, trade deals, you know, the pipeline, the potential pipeline with Iran, you know, is this really and truly sort of really about, you know, if a political party can deliver on the local level and it's, you know, the issues of foreign policy and, you know, state to state trade deals aren't really an issue or in the mind of the Pakistani electorate?
I want to be cautious about sort of ascribing views to the Pakistani electorate, because I think I can only sort of go on, again, from afar what I'm sort of able to discern. There is the reality that elected civilian governments in Pakistan still are not going to have huge leeway on the conduct of foreign policy. I think that's still pretty much understood to be the case, that the military has a dominant role, which is not to say that the military hasn't worked with the current civilian government on some issues. I think it's actually been kind of interesting in relations with the U.S., particularly the last year, where we had sort of the debate over closing NATO supply lines, and then after the November 2001 incident, cross-border incident, the military and the civilian leadership actually kind of played a sort of tag team role on that issue. Obviously, I don't know sort of what all went on behind closed doors, but generally speaking, they sort of played a united front on that. But anyways, all that that point aside, I mean, I do certainly I mean, certainly there's, I think, a big message, at least on the part of the opposition parties, the PMLN, the PTI, these other groups that are sort of seeking to challenge the incumbent. There's certainly a lot of nationalist messages of sort of renewal and revival in the sense that sort of Pakistan has been led astray over the past 5 years. And I think foreign policy does play a pretty big role in that. The drone strikes are an obvious example where, you know, regardless of what the leadership may or may not think behind closed doors on how useful these strikes might be to target militant actors that they themselves don't necessarily want to take the steps to deal with or can't. I think, you know, it has sort of compounded this sense that Pakistan is kind of besieged, that the U.S. is pushing Pakistan around, particularly in 2001, I mean, which was sort of the low point in the relationship. You had the Raymond Davis incident, you had the Bin Laden raid, and then you had this cross-border issue, and I think and this may have impacted the military perceptions of the military as well as the civilians, but just sort of this sense that Pakistan it needs to sort of stand up. So, I mean, there's been a lot of rhetoric about sort of Pakistan casting off the pressures of the United States or asserting itself. To what extent that will actually move beyond sort of election rhetoric, I'm not sure. I think it would depend. And it would depend on sort of a lot of factors, but including sort of what the makeup of the coalition that emerges might be. On issues like India, I mean, I think there's my sense is that Pakistani leaders, civilian and military, recognize that given all their other problems right now domestically and with the U.S. and with Afghanistan, they really don't need to be starting new problems with India. And I think it's actually the trade proposal. My impression is that it actually, for the most part, has pretty broad consensus support amongst at least the political elites. The PMLN, Nawaz Sharif, I think, has actually generally been supportive of this. Even the opposition has been supportive of this. But there are still plenty of special interest groups in Pakistan, whether that's in the business community or whether that's groups like Hafiz Saeed in the sort of leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba and the sort of Islamic militant community. Who obviously have some vested interest in not going forward with these improvements. And the military's exact perspective on this, I think, is a little unclear, although given how far it progressed, I would assume it would not have progressed as far as it did without at least some degree of military support. But lately it's broken down, partly on the Pakistani side, due to these sorts of internal vested interests against cooperation, and then partly on the Indian side, as we've had these conflicts in Kashmir in January, a bit of a flare up there, which has sort of resulted in them calling off some visa agreements, and sort of now I think we're back to kind of a stall.
So let's slightly switch gears. We've discussed what I'm interpreting as mostly secular parties. You know, what is the role of the Islamist parties, of sort of Jamiat Islamiyah, Ulama Islam Fazl, JUIF, and JI? Yeah. You know, what is their role? I mean, you made the point, you know, earlier, if I heard you correctly, that these parties, they're not really popular. So in the broader electorate, you know, what do they represent, and, you know, what is their role?
Right. Well, I mean, these groups do have bases of support. Some of them are quite dedicated, but in terms of broad appeal, generally speaking, they have not reached the level of the other major parties. And those are the two main ones, Jamaat Islami and the JOIF, but there are several, I mean, there are many, many more of varying sectarian bents or schools of Islam or clerical leadership or what have you. The Jamaat Islami boycotted the last election. It's generally more of an urban sort of elite party. It's particularly in Karachi has previously had some success there, but the JUIF has been one of these sorts of kingmaker groups that sort of allies with everybody at one point or another in time, trying to broker deals in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Balochistan elsewhere. Again, not likely to both of these parties, not likely to gain significant support, but depending on the makeup of parliament, can potentially extract concessions, whether in terms of ministry appointments or policy decisions, potentially can extract some concessions from whomever they end up throwing their support to. And then you do have sort of more, I don't really like the I think the term extreme is a little vague, but you do have sort of harder line groups, which it's interesting to, and some of these overlap, but I mean, I think, for example, in 2000, when last year, when we had the debate over sort of reopening, 2012, the debate over reopening the NATO supply lines, you had this Defense of Pakistan Coalition, or Defense of Pakistan Council, which was sort of a coalition of mostly smaller religious parties. JI was a member, JUIF was not. And they sort of, you could kind of see as the debate was playing out over do we reopen supply lines? What kind of apology do we need from the Americans before we do this? You could sort of see the Defense of Pakistan group would sort of stake out an extreme position, and then the JUIF, which was not a member, would kind of move forward to follow that, and then the PMLN would kind of move forward to follow the JUIF. So on the margins, these more harder-line Islamist groups can potentially sort of shift the terms of the debate. But that being said, in the end, the military officials and the government officials got together and agreed to reopen it anyways for, I think, general strategic calculations that ultimately prevailed. So so the Islamist parties, I think I would expect there will be some, I mean, there will be some Islamist parties entering into parliament, but to what degree they play a role in shaping government policy, right now, not really clear.
So where do we put sort of, you know, the Afghan and the Pakistani Taliban? Do they, you know, do they have a weight on the electorate? Do they sort of can shape the election? I mean, it seems that, you know, if really the I'm going to put this in quotes, the accepted Islamist parties aren't really doing that well. You know, what is the effect or the weight and the weight, effect and weight of the Pakistani Taliban? You know, is there, you know, or is there weight, you know, less politics and more violence?
Right. Well, you know, to go all Clausewitzian, the Pakistani Taliban do participate in politics through violence. I guess that's their means of participating. They're not, I mean, the Pakistani Taliban are a fairly loose group of local militants in the federally administered tribal areas, and they are not going to be taking part in elections as such. They're not a political party or anything like that. And to my knowledge, are not affiliated with any political parties, at least closely on sort of an official level. But they have, you know, they have issued threats against basically all the mainstream political parties. They have assassinated particularly several ANP leaders in Kyber-Pakhtunkhwa, but also, you know, have also even targeted other Islamist parties like the JUIF or the JAI. And of course, these Islamist parties generally don't acknowledge that it was the Pakistani Taliban targeting them. But yeah, they are going to, these groups are going to, the Pakistani Taliban and other militant groups are going to shape the outcomes by the security impact they have on the elections, which recently, so far, it's been something of a lull. Comparatively, it's not been, I mean, there have still been attacks, but earlier in February and before that, you had a bit of a discussion, a bit of back and forth, where you had Pakistani Taliban spokesmen suggesting that they would be open to peace negotiations with the government. And some of the political parties, most of the political parties, through a couple of conferences in Islamabad, endorsed this idea. I think, but it did not end up going anywhere. And now the Pakistani Taliban have said, "Well, you kind of missed your opportunity. We're still going to keep attacking you." They never offered to give up their weapons. They really offered very little in the way of concessions. And the political party's endorsement of the idea never really gained much specificity either. I mean, it's difficult, given sort of the general, very few right now, very few Pakistani political leaders want to be endorsing military action in the Northwest. Partly, probably just due to the self-interest of these are the people who have to sort of campaign in these areas and try and go out and hold rallies and win votes. And that's, as has particularly been seen for the ANP, a very dangerous proposition still. I think the hope on the part of some of the political parties was that by endorsing the idea of talks, they could perhaps win a bit of despite not sure that will actually be borne out, and in terms of long-term peace negotiations seems pretty unlikely. The Pakistani Taliban is not the only militant group in the country. Obviously, you have Baloch separatist groups still in Balochistan, which have indicated that they some of them still will be conducting attacks primarily on the security services there, but and then you have sectarian groups like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which has been very violently carrying out attacks on Shia residents of Quetta and parts of Balochistan, but is also active in Punjab and other parts of the country. And the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi has a political wing, which by some reports is in fact going to contest the elections despite nominally being banned. And depending on who you believe, they have potentially reached an agreement with the PMLN for kind of an agreement not to run candidates against each other in parts of southern Punjab, although there's been some denials of that. And I'm not sure that the actual candidacy itself has yet been filed if it is going to happen.
So for our last segment, I want to sort of – the sense I got from reading the report is that Pakistan is on this sort of movement from, you know, a very centralized political system to a very decentralized political system.
Yeah.
Now, so for this, you know, this last part, I'm curious then, is this going to be – you know, is this potentially a permanent trend in Pakistan where – Not necessarily permanent, but let me reword that. But sort of a trend that's going to be in, you know, Pakistani politics for a very long time, because it seems that, you know, from reading your, you know, report, that, you know, there's very much a movement from military rule to civilian rule, to sort of a, you know, a messier civilian rule where, power is not just in the capital, but it's also in the provinces, in this sort of federated system. So, I mean, what do you see as, do you see this as sort of a, a long trend, or is it more a hiccup of in history, in this recent history?
Well, I mean, I guess it's probably a dangerous game to try and predict exactly what's going to happen here, given sort of the, as I said, I mean, there has been a cycle in the past where you've had these centralizing military authorities, which have then eventually been ousted or in one form or another, and a shift towards decentralization. I mean, I'm coming to Pakistan. I've basically been following it for the past 5 years, so. There's perhaps a bit of observation bias there. But that being said, I do think there have been some structural shifts. At least it appears to me that there have been some structural shifts in the Pakistani political system that, while it's not impossible for a military leader to come back and sort of say, well, that was fun, but we're done with this for now. I think it would be much more difficult. It seems to me that it would be much more difficult for that to happen than it did than perhaps it did in the past. Partly just because I think Pakistani politicians are learning to a considerable degree. I mean, the Pakistani opposition, the PMLN, they have been a concerted opposition for much of the past 5 years. But they have not, to my knowledge, they have not turned to sort of extra constitutional means. They have not gone to the military and said, the PPP is just screwing this up so badly. We need you to put us in charge. That has not happened. You've had the, I mean, you have had the proliferation of the media, which, the media, you have had the courts. You have had these new sort of new power centers, which I think may be diffuse enough that it is the system may be decentralized enough now that for any one party, even the military, to try and sort of rein it back in, I think would be a challenge. Not to say it's impossible. I mean, the military still is the biggest economic actor in the country. It still obviously controls the guns and a lot of the security policy. But, the military's relationship with the US is uncertain. The military's relationship with China, I think, is often oversold. But I don't get the sense that. At least under the current leadership, that they are looking to sort of dramatically overturn things. I'm not sure what the next leadership will look like, but I think generally speaking, I mean, you've had these more structural trends. You've had the shift, I mean, continuing shift to urbanization, which is going to sort of change the way politics works, potentially change the way politics works, the way interest groups sort of form. So I guess I mean, at least speaking right now, I'm actually fairly optimistic that that we will see continuity. Now it's going to be I'm not sure what the experience of the next 5 years is going to be, whether the next government will in fact manage to last 5 years. But I think, it is a milestone for Pakistan to have come to this point where they have completed a full term in office. The government is, the negotiations over the sort of machinery for the election process is taking place between the government and the opposition. They've come to consensus, or they've followed the constitutional processes on that. And now the government, has to go and defend its record, which most Pakistani governments in the past have not had to do. So it will be interesting to see what the response is. But generally speaking, I think. At least right now, I think we are likely to see continue this sort of sort of more decentralized, more federalized, more multipolar system. And so the challenge for the US or for anybody else is sort of how are we going to interact with that?
Those are some good points. So we've reached the sort of the end of the conversation. I'm you know, I always, you know, let my guests have the last word. So, you know, is there any other points that we sort of missed or that you want to sort of make?
No, I mean, I think we covered most of it. I mean, just for anybody who is interested in following along on the elections, I mean, the date is May 11th. If possible, I'm going to be there for the elections. I'm still trying to figure out the schedule. But yeah, we'll have about another month of sort of contesting candidacies and probably some contests, legal contests over voter registration and these sorts of things. But assuming things happen according to plan, the vote will be on May 11th, and then we will get to see what kind of coalition comes out of this.
Well, thank you so much. You know, come back after the election and, you know, hopefully talk to us about, you know, what happened.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.